So here we are making our way through the last day and the 40 days after that. Our last day obviously was the day that Jesus was crucified. Disciples thought it was the end and the last of the last, and now they're in the middle of the 40 days after that. And so we're just kind of making our way through, looking at the various discoveries that the disciples made as they find themselves in this new era. So if you want to continue that, and we'll take a break from this next week on Mother's Day as Keith presents part two of his series. But for today, let's look at some of these things that the disciples are learning through. So on your notes, on the back of your bulletin, it's now been 4 weeks since Jesus' resurrection. It's clear to all the disciples that Jesus does not intend to reestablish the familiar routine they enjoyed before that nightmare of a week in Jerusalem. The newest and fast-growing dread is that the group is on its own to create some new organizational structure in order to accomplish what Jesus has asked of them. They know they're not to be like the Pharisees or leaders of the Gentiles. They know that heart issues trump outward actions, and they know that they have a divine lover whose love seems impossible to categorize, much less put into words. In this jumble of fresh and ever-surprising realities, they're led back to Jesus' teachings about being like little children and being servants, and to figuring out how to apply those teachings. So, if we can kind of put ourselves back in the position of these disciples who are, you know, they're still reeling from what we refer to as Holy Week, I think they would have a different way of describing the week, Jesus' last week on earth. It didn't seem very holy to them, and I'm sure they would have many other descriptors, but we refer to it as Holy Week. And they're still trying to figure out what all that meant and what happened and what went wrong and how did we end up where we are now and what's Jesus doing? He's here, but he's not always with us. He's not camping out with us. He just shows up every once in a while. And so things have really changed in that regard. And they're coming more and more to this agreement, this understanding that maybe some of these things we didn't quite get early on really are important for us to capture now. And so as they're looking at, well, how do we organize? How do we structure this thing that Jesus has given us to do? We have this message, but just like us, you know, you're starting a, someone starts a business. How many businesses have been started in the United States in the last couple hundred years? I mean, probably thousands of businesses. But every time somebody for the first time starts a business, the question is, how do I do this? What do I have to do? What do I need to know? Who do I contact? What kind of pieces of the puzzle do I have to put together? How much do I need to know before I get this thing started? And so there's all kinds of things that need to be discussed ahead of time. And so the disciples are there realizing, I think Jesus was really serious about giving us this work to do. So how on earth are we, on earth literally, are we going to make this thing happen? Because up until now, we've totally depended on Jesus to give direction for every new thing we did. He taught, he led, he guided, he made decisions, and we, to the best of our ability, followed along. Only now it really seems like he intends to entrust this mission, this commission of a kingdom that he endowed us with. And they're getting a little frightened that this might be more than they can handle. And so in their processes and the thinking back and forth, someone says, well, what did Jesus say about children? Seems like he had this recurring theme about children. And so I want to just look at a few of these verses this morning, just nothing earth-shattering, but or maybe it is. I don't know. So number one here in the A, being like children. They're going back and thinking of what did Jesus teach us about children that was maybe shocking even. So in Matthew 18, the first four verses, they're realizing here that your blank is mandatory for greatness. Being like children is mandatory for greatness. It's the weirdest thing they've ever heard, probably the weirdest thing we've ever heard. And I doubt if there are too many guides to becoming tomorrow's CEO of a Fortune 500 company that requires humility and being like children as one of the prerequisites. But here we are in Matthew 18, 1 through 4. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" See, it's all a matter of greatness. Who's the biggest? Number one, who's top dog? He called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, "I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Now, we might have read these words hundreds of times before, but for the disciples, they were asking, who's the greatest? Now, if we were asking that similar question, you know, as employees of a company, and, you know, there's about to be maybe a promotion or something, and, you know, everyone's kind of discussing amongst themselves who's going to really get this promotion, who's most worthy, who's been the most dedicated, who's put in the most extra hours, who's presented the best new ideas, fresh ideas, who's earned the company millions of dollars. It's that kind of thing. And the disciples are kind of wondering about that too, like, which one of us is the best? I mean, who does Jesus like the best? And who's he going to promote to top dog? So verses 1 through 4, the disciples are having this discussion. And in answer to their discussion, Jesus brings a little child, like a little 5-year-old. And he has him stand in the midst. They're like, okay, what's this about? And Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, unless you change, you guys, and become like this little child, you can't even enter the kingdom of heaven. And therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." To which the disciples are saying, "Jesus, you've got to be kidding. That's not the way it works." And they're thinking back now to this teaching, and they're like, "We have this big job to do. We're extending God's kingdom as Jesus taught us." Now, Pentecost hasn't happened, and they don't understand fully yet the aspect of the Holy Spirit. And so we can't cheat. We got to wait till a few more weeks before we get there. But they're trying to figure out what Jesus' teaching has to do with them today, every bit as much as we as disciples in 2015 need to also figure out what does Jesus' teaching about being little children have to do with us and the way we live our lives. And so Jesus sets this little boy amongst them and says, unless you become just like him, you can't enter the kingdom. And they're now sitting amongst themselves, just the disciples, and they're going, how is this going to work? How do we present kingdom and God's love and God's redemption and the work he wants to do in us, and yet we're to present it as if we're little children? And yes, little children, of course, are sweet and charming and disarming and adorable and huggable most of the time. And yet Jesus is using this little boy that he brings into their midst as the example, as the prototype of what it is to be a kingdom citizen. And so as they're looking at leadership stuff and organizational skills, he's like, well, all the disciples are going, well, what organizational skills does a 5-year-old have? I mean, they barely get dressed on their own. They don't make their own beds. You know, they don't organize. They don't clean up on their own. They don't make their own meals. So, you know, the parallels just seem to keep falling apart. They're like, how is this going to work? And then he says, unless you guys change, because they need to change and to become like this little child. So would Jesus say that to us this morning? Unless you guys change and become like this little 5-year-old, if I thought ahead, I would have brought a 5-year-old up here so we could have a glimpse. We would have grabbed Nathan if he wasn't in here and say, unless you become just like Nathan, you can't even enter the kingdom. You've got to be like this child. And everything in us, everything in our adult organizational me first mentality screams at this stuff. And yet Jesus seems to make a very strong point, because they're, first of all, the disciples are talking about who's the greatest, and he just brings it all the way back. He just dials down to a five-year-old. He said, there's your example. Just follow him and you'll be great. And so now the disciples are really thinking that they have a lot to learn, because they haven't really understood that. And they've never seen any other leadership other than Jesus take that kind of an attitude. The second thing, in Matthew 19, verses 13 and 14, being like children is a key to the kingdom. That's your blank there, is a key to the kingdom, verses 13 and 14. Little children were brought to Jesus for him to place his hands on them and pray for them, but the disciples rebuked those who brought them. They were getting in the way. Jesus didn't have time for this. Jesus has ministry to do, you know? I mean, there are a lot of things that Jesus has to accomplish, and he's a busy guy, and he's tired. And please don't bring all those kids in here. That really messes things up. And Jesus said, let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them. For the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. And when he had placed his hands on them, he went out from there. Wow. How many movers and shakers in our society would make time for children? Say, in the midst of their rushing around and all the busy things on their agenda and all the little beeps on their phone that remind them there's another meeting, oops, there's another meeting, beep, there's another meeting, how many would just say, you know what, it's also more important, there goes one right now, see, there's another meeting? And Jesus says the children are also very important. As a matter of fact, they're the kingdom of heaven belongs to children, to the humble, to those who are not yet wise in the ways of the world, those who don't know and don't have the sophistication to manipulate people to do what they want. Well, maybe little children have some means of manipulation, but it's usually pretty obvious. And some parents are still wrapped around fingers, I guess. But for the most part, you can see when children are trying to manipulate. You know, they're hard. It's hard for them to hide their wily ways, trying to get something. And they, you know, if they're being super cute, you know, that something's really up. It's like, okay. And I'm not a parent, but for you parents, I'm sure you could tell many stories of the exceeding cuteness of someone who has just done something or who really wants something. And so, but Jesus says, again, in a very surprising fashion, the kingdom of heaven belongs to children, like people like this, these little ones who don't know those kind of things yet. And the disciples are still just scratching their head going, but it doesn't make sense. It seems like it's upside down. This doesn't seem to work this way. And yet, here's this other instance where Jesus makes a point of bringing children into the midst and saying, don't prevent them from coming to me. They're very important to me. I want to minister to children. I want them in my midst, because the kingdom of heaven has to be made up of them and not those who feel like they know it all. And so, in the midst of the confusion, I think there's probably creeping in a little bit of relief for the disciples. It's like, huh, so maybe we don't have to know everything. Maybe it's okay not to know everything. Maybe it's okay not to have every last detail nailed down before we do this thing. And just maybe, even the likes of us, as the disciples are looking at each other, they're going, you know, maybe Jesus really has confidence that we can get this job done. I mean, maybe that was to be an encouragement, not just a confusing thing, but to say, you don't have to be so high and mighty and so glorious with 8 degrees behind your name before you can do anything that's of significance. But just maybe this thing is far simpler, far less complicated than we have a tendency to make it. And certainly far less complicated than what the Jews had made of this relationship with God. And they'd made it into this religion with lots of rules and lots of regulations. And so they're starting to get maybe a little understanding here. Number three, But just when they think they've got it down, Jesus does this to them in Mark 9, verses 33 through 37. It's a continuation of what he said before, but it's disturbing. Mark 9, 33. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" You know, it's like, don't you hate that? You know, you're kind of talking amongst yourself. You don't want anyone to know. And basically, they're busted now. But they kept quiet, verse 34, because on the way, they had argued again about who was the greatest. Of course, Jesus knew that, and they knew that Jesus knew that because he had those kind of piercing eyes. And, you know, it's just like, you know, when your mother asks you, like, what have you been doing? You know full well she knows what you've been doing, and you don't really want to discuss it because you know it's going to get you in trouble, but you also know it's too late because she already knows, because mothers know everything. That's what we'll be talking about next week, I'm sure. And so, but he knew what they've been talking about, and they wanted to know who is the greatest, which one of us do you think, you know, and they're kind of going back and forth. So sitting down, Jesus called the 12, verse 35, and said, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." Again, he took a little child and had him stand among them. Taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever becomes like one of these little children in my name, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but welcomes the one who sent me." Whoever wants to be first, so here's the new order. Last is first. Sweet. The last is first. And the first is last, basically. Whoever wants to be first, whoever wants to be the greatest, number one, top dog, whatever, well, he says, he must be the very last and the servant of all. And so the disciples now, they're looking here, and they look at these different passages of Scripture that Jesus has talked about, how important children are, and they make up the kingdom, and unless we become like children, we can't even get to the kingdom. And then he says, if you really want to be great, you have to be last. And they're like, okay, how are we going to do this? I mean, we know this is what Jesus said, and he brings children into the picture over and over and over again, and it seems like just the point where we feel like we're going to get a promotion and he's going to name, you know, the A1 disciple on Jesus' list, he ignores us and brings in a child and say, here's your example, guys. How you doing? How are you matching up? Or matching down, I should say. And so, being like children is this recurring theme, and just, we'll look there, but at the Last Supper, when Jesus is sitting around the table, and he says to them, I've so eagerly desired to have this meal with you this time, and then as he's talking to them, he looks at them all, and you know what he says? Little children. To his disciples. Jesus is so full of love and affection for this group of guys who've wandered the hills and the valleys and the rivers and the roads with him for 3 years, listening to his teaching and trying to get caught up to speed. And then this very last meal before he suffers, he looks around the table and as they're all reclining there, and he says, he refers to them as little children. One version says, my dear children. These are adults. These are men. But Jesus says, little children. Because he understands that they're fearful and they don't really know what's next. And they don't really know where they're going. And they don't really know much about this mission that's being given to them. And I think that's such a loving thing for Jesus to do, to look at these disciples and say, little children. Giving them permission to not know, to not be comfortable, to have fears, to have insecurities, and it's okay. You know, when a little child is frightened and or has a bad dream and comes running into his parents' bedroom at night, you know, most parents don't go, what do you think you're doing? Get back in bed right now. You know, if the child comes running and screaming or crying or sobbing, usually there's some compassion in the middle of the night, and there's just some time spent to put the kid back to sleep and back in his own bed, hopefully. But so Jesus looks at these disciples and he calls them little children. Just not like he doesn't know. He fully knows what's in their hearts and in their minds and the fears they have as they work their way through the stuff of this now called Holy Week. And so they're getting this picture. And so someone says, okay, well, yeah, we really have to be like children. But, you know, it seems like it fits in here with what he talked about being servants. So in B, not just like children, which was a hard enough hill to climb, but now it's being servants. So let's look at Mark chapter 10, verse 35 to 45. And this ends up being giving your life as a ransom. Mark 10, 35. Then James and John, here they go again. You know, this is a recurring theme amongst these disciples. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Whew. Can you imagine coming to Jesus with that kind of a request? We want you to do for us whatever we ask. And so he says, well, what do you want me to do for you? They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. I wonder how many of those discussions about who were the greatest were started with James and John. You know, I wonder how many times that issue came up, you know, and they're kind of egging on. And now they've, at this point here in this passage, they get really bold. I mean, they just, you know what? Jesus is not about to promote us. So I think he wants us to show that we're worthy and that we're ready and that we're on target. And so we'll just present ourselves. We'll just put our CV out in front of him and see what he thinks. What do you want me to do? Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. He says, you do not know what you're asking. Jesus said, can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? And very confidently they say, we can. Really? So Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. When the other guys heard about this, they became indignant with James and John, because basically they've been thinking the same thing too, and it was just easy to get angry with the two that had just asked him. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So this bold request with great confidence that yes, we can drink this cup and be baptized with this baptism. And then Jesus said, well, that's really not for me to even grant to you. But here's the example of greatness one more time. It's being servants, being a servant of all. And then he says, and then the example I'm showing you is to be one who serves to the point of giving his life as a ransom. In the song Redeemed this morning, we sang, I've been redeemed. Jesus came to redeem. The French word is racheter, to buy back. So Jesus says, I have come and that in giving my life, I will buy back many. And he's saying, and this is my example to you. Here's the servanthood I'm talking about. This is what your job is. This is what I'm asking of you, to also give your lives away, invest yourselves in saving many from sin. I didn't come to be served, but to serve. This is my example I'm setting for you, Jesus is saying, and then to give my life as a ransom for many. And so what the disciples, James and John, and the other 10 as well, of course, are thinking. You know, they're still thinking a hierarchy of authority. Who's going to have the biggest authority? Who's going to have the gold robe? Who's going to have the gold throne? Maybe not quite to that extent, but they're certainly thinking in terms of human greatness, the power structures, who rules, whose voice carries the furthest, whose decision-making makes the most waves. They're kind of looking at that, thinking, hey, maybe there is something cool to be thought about. And Jesus keeps shooting them down and going, no, 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 guys, it's not like that. You're still thinking like the rulers of the Gentiles. And it's not to be that way with you, he says in verse 43. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. So as they ponder these things over again, now after the resurrection, and they're thinking, we need to institute some of that. We need to proceed building this, what will be the church, based on these teachings Jesus has given us. How do we do that? How do we give leadership being humble and being like children? And of course, as we look at the last 21 centuries, the church hasn't done a really great job of staying humble and being servants. You know, we forget sometimes that that's what we've been called to, and those are Jesus' words to his disciples who are meant to be examples to us. And over the centuries, our old natures have kicked in, and lots of structure and lots of rules and regulations and all kinds of horrible things have happened, wars even, over following Jesus. You know, it's just a crazy thing that we have developed. And yet here are these words that the disciples are really struggling with. We know we've got a job to do, and Jesus seems to have told us how we're going to do it, but he certainly, you know, he set the bar so low, we don't even know whether it's even going to work. And so the last thing I want us to look at is this passage out of John 13, and example of serving. Jesus says, be servants, and so he modeled being a servant for the disciples at the Last Supper, and it was pretty shocking there too. And so at least he didn't talk about it in theory only. He manifested it. He showed it to his disciples over and over again. But this is probably the most telling one, and it's the one given in most detail in Scripture. So it's worth looking at. Verses 1 through 17 here. Very familiar passage. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. Is this interesting? Right here he says, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning from God to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. He did this thing that was humiliating. Have you ever been in a place where everybody was super dressed up and you showed up in jeans and t-shirt? Or have you ever shown up completely dressed to the nines and everybody else was in cutoffs and t-shirts? Or have you ever shown up at a pastor's funeral and you're going to be processing in to the funeral with a group of 50 pastors and you're the only pastor there who's not in a robe? And all the pastors say, where's your robe? I don't have a robe. Can I still process in with the pastors? So, not only was I the only white guy in the midst of 50 black pastors, I was the only white cracker with no robe, and it was really awful. So, talk about standing out in a crowd, you know. And I'm taller than everybody before me and everybody after me, you know. So, it's really obvious that I'm processing, and it's like, everybody's, I'm sure they're all thinking, what on earth is he doing here? So, anyway, it was pretty bad. So, that's my confession. But it's really uncomfortable sometimes to be totally different from everybody else, you know? And so here's Jesus. He gets up from the table. All the guys are there with their regular clothes and everything. He takes off his outer clothing and just basically his underwear, what a servant would wear, the short tunic. He wraps a towel around his waist, which is what the servant of the household would do normally, and would meet you at the door as you came in as a guest for dinner, and they would wash. Everyone wore sandals, of course. And so the typical way of greeting someone in a home would be just to wash their feet, just wash the sand and the dust off people's feet to refresh them. It was just a standard hospitality, and of course, nobody did that. And of course, none of the disciples were going to take that role. And so Jesus gets up from the table and he transforms himself into a servant for everybody. Now it's really embarrassing because here's the leader and he's the one who is underdressed and you're all there. You were comfortably seated, but now it's really uncomfortable because he's basically not dressed and he's taking this role of a servant and he's getting, I'm sure when Jesus picked up a bowl and poured water into the bowl, the disciples were all cringing inside. It's like, oh no. Not, oh no, oh no. He can't do this to us. And of course, we have Peter's response here. So let's keep going. He got up from the meal in verse 4, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, and after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. Came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus replied, you do not realize what I am doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. I'm not going to put myself in a position of being humiliated by having my leader serve me in this kind of an undignified way. No way, that's not happening. And Jesus said, unless I wash you, you have no part of me. Boy, Jesus had some zingers, didn't he? I mean, didn't he? He just knew how to say, unless I wash your feet, you have no part of me. Well, that brought Peter right back to his senses. And so then he's always so, you know, so measured, Peter. He says, well, then, Lord, Simon Peter answered, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. And Jesus answered, a person who has had a bath only needs to wash his feet. His whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean. And so, and it's interesting here that Judas hasn't left yet. And so it would be assumed that maybe Jesus washed his feet as well. When he finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. Do you understand what I have done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that's what I am. But now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. Holy smokes. I mean, Jesus has just done something that is so out there. And not just out there leaving them to figure out, like, what just happened. He tells them, I've set you an example that you should wash one another's feet. Now, there are some parts of the church who believe that one of the ordinances Jesus set up here is to have foot washing ceremonies. I personally don't think that's what Jesus was doing. He did foot washing because that was a very ordinary, everyday thing that a servant would do when you came into a household. It's what everyone would expect. You know, it's like taking your coat, offering you a seat, giving you coffee, whatever. You know, just standard hospitality procedure that would be the place and would be the role of someone who was the servant in the household. And so Jesus says, you call me teacher and Lord, and that's good because I am. Teacher and Lord. But he said, now that I, your Lord and teacher, he's really emphasizing, he's not ignoring the fact, he's not saying, oh no, no, it's not like that, don't call me that, no. He's saying, no, I am Lord and teacher, you're right, but now that I, as Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also now wash one another's feet. In other words, he's acting out in front of them in a way they will never forget. Jesus, kneeling down on the floor in front of them and taking their dusty feet and washing them. They have never, ever had anyone but a servant of a household, a nameless, faceless servant, do that job. But this time, they will never forget having their feet washed. They can hardly probably look at Jesus as he's doing it. Can you imagine as he's washing their feet, looking up and looking into their face? I mean, that would be pretty humiliating, wouldn't it? It's like, wow, this is the Lord and the Master, and he's washing my feet. And so Jesus said, but this is your example. I'm setting you an example. This is what you're to do for one another. And so not only have they pondered all this thing about being little children and being humble and all of that, but this servanthood, giving your life as a ransom, just giving your life away, being willing to do whatever it takes to ransom people, bring them back, to win them, to call them out of their lifestyle of sin. And then this crazy example of serving that Jesus set before them and very clearly said, this is how you're to lead, by serving one another. And so just as the disciples were trying to figure out right then, those first days after the resurrection, how are we to lead? How are we to give direction to this thing? How are we to live lives as disciples of Jesus? And he gives them these wild examples that have nothing to do with the power structure of the day. And I would say they have nothing to do with the power structure of today either. And so here we are, we're making our way through and looking at what does the world need? And, you know, Keith was praying earlier about, you know, a need for peacemakers and people living in a way that would bring peace and not strife. And we have no end of strife in our world. And so as things get darker and more difficult for us to give leadership by being like children and serving people, I think Jesus speaks to us and asks us the same thing. You know, I don't want you to be the big kahuna or wherever else it might be. I just want to lead by serving. I want you to help people. I want you to serve them. I want you to take the one down position. Don't always have to win the argument. Don't always have to have the last word. Serve people. And I think our world will not know what to do with the church, whose role it is and whose role they assume and take up is there to serve. So let's be those who lead by serving, who lead by giving themselves away for others, and who take a childlike position and not have to prove that they're the best or the biggest or the strongest or the loudest, but just be there for people. And Jesus says, you'll be blessed if you do it. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for your love for us. Thank you for the wild teachings, the way your kingdom moves forward in ways that we couldn't possibly understand apart from your teaching. And even today, 2,100 years later, we still barely can get what's going on. We still barely understand. And yet your Spirit comes to teach us and to instruct us and give us wisdom. And so as we're faced with circumstances this week, Father, could we realize that we are not greater than our Master and he washed his disciples' feet. So in all things, Father, could we give that kind of leadership? Could we model what you modeled for us? And could the world stand in awe? Because Jesus said, they will know that you're my disciples by the love you have for one another. And in so many circles today, there's just not much brotherly love being expressed. And could you grace us, Father, with the strength to move forward and express brotherly love one to another and to this world that is so hurting and so in need of the good news of the gospel? You're the only way, and we know you. So, Father, help us and grace us, strengthen us and encourage us in this job of extending your kingdom like little children willing to be last. Thank you for your grace. Thank you for your Spirit guiding us, reminding us of all these things Jesus said, and giving us discernment as to how to live them out and apply them. And we're grateful for your presence here in this place this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. And again, as we said earlier, we would love to pray. So if you would like prayer this morning, please come or nab somebody near you, and we would love to do that. Thank you. Have a wonderful, warm, sunny day.